Between 2015 and 2018, the Federal Reserve raised interest rates not two times, not four times, but nine times. The Fed funds rate in December 2015 was 0.25. In December 2018, 3 years later, it was 2.5, which means nine interest rate hikes of a quarter point each. I would like one person from your huge audience, one person to show me any evidence that in those 3 years, cap rates did not continue to decline at the same rate as before 2015 and after 2018.
Hello, hello. Welcome to the Five Talents Podcast. I'm your host, Abel Pacheco. I interview the top commercial real estate investors and industry experts so you can learn from their experiences. So if you're an investor, a high W-2 earner, or real estate or tech sales professional that wants to invest in real estate without having to manage properties or leave your day job, then this podcast is for you. Or if you're already investing in real estate, but you're doing it part-time and you want to become a full-time multifamily or full-time commercial real estate investor, this podcast is for you too. You're going to learn a ton. You will learn from real-life multifamily investors and other professionals in the industry. They're going to share their blueprints for success, and I'm super excited that you're here. So I hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, my name is Abel Pacheco. I'm your host for the Five Talents Podcast. We are super excited today to have one of those amazing guests, one of those individuals that has left his mark on multifamily, on commercial real estate investing, on raising capital, on social presence, branding, data, and so many different realms and area. He's done hundreds of millions of dollars. Literally, I'll let him talk about his numbers and numbers of thousands of doors that he's invested in and all the capital that he's raised. But Mr. Neil Bawa, the mad scientist of multifamily, thank you so much for joining, Neil. How's it going, brother?
Fantastic. Great to be back on the podcast. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah, man. I'm appreciative and humbled that we would have you. And I'm excited because we have a lot of great information. And I know that all of the sources of data and all the areas that you're in, multifamily and commercial real estate investing, you're really going to provide a lot of good knowledge today for a lot of our passive investors, a lot of people that are trying to figure out, is this the right time to invest? I'm worried about the trends going on in the market. I see the stock market doing X, Y, and Z, and I don't know whether to jump into real estate or not, or I don't know, passive or not, or all these things that are going through people's minds. You're right in the center of it, and I know you're going to provide a lot of great insight. So let me turn it over to you for a second, Neil, if you can, for the listeners that may not know who you are. Give us a proper introduction. Tell us who you are and what you do, and maybe a little bit of your stats and data, and then we'll just start a great conversation, brother.
Sure. I'm a technologist. I'm a dork. I'm a nerd. I'm steeped in Silicon Valley lore. Think of me as a data scientist. My friends call me the mad scientist of multifamily, and I prefer to be called the mad scientist of real estate now because I'm going well beyond multifamily, which was something that's always near to my heart. Lots of geeks and dorks that follow me. There's about 50,000 people, investors, that use our toolkits. So we provide toolkits that have no subscription. They're completely 100% free. We update them once in a year. There's about 12,000 accredited investors that are in our database. Currently, we're at 4,500 doors. The portfolio is just shy of 900 million. And we raise about between $75 and $100 million a year for our projects, which are a mix of a bunch of things. Unlike most people on Abel's podcast, I don't restrict myself to any one vertical. So I do multifamily value add, multifamily new construction, student housing, active adult 55 plus, self-storage, industrial, and build to rent. And I'm definitely missing something. Total of 32 assets in 10 states. But none of that is as interesting to me as a couple things. I do this because it's fantastically interesting to me to look at trends, to look at data, to look at what's happening in our bizarre, manipulated market. And that's what I enjoy the most. I also really enjoy having a foundational understanding of the market. So those are things that are very interesting to me. And I like finding unique niches. So one of the niches, and where I'm happy to discuss this because I don't think anyone talks about it, is called super value add. So currently we are the only super value add syndicator in the United States. And we have multiple projects where we've done super value add. I think most people would be interested in knowing about it. I'm also the only syndicator in the US that does fourplex pre-sales. So essentially, instead of raising money from investors, we do a fourplex project and we raise the money from buyers of those fourplexes and we use their money to build them. So I like these kinds of unique things because they're very difficult to do. They're involved in an extraordinary amount of structuring, and that's what keeps me ticking. I like doing difficult things. And so the portions of my portfolio that are actually the least interesting to me are the projects that were just, hey, there's a $70 million building. It's 250 units. We built it in this great market, and the rents are already much higher than we thought they were. That may sound very interesting to most people. That's actually the least interesting to me because there was nothing there that I could apply my mind to. It was just our investors liked it and it was a nice building and people will make money. So to me, I think if it doesn't have experimentation, if I can't fiddle with it in 17 different ways and push 91 knobs, it's not as interesting.
Which is just even hearing that, what I hear a lot times is I want something boring and simple, and I want my investment essentially as boring as possible. And like you said, hey, that was the $70 million deal and the numbers work and that's great. But like you said, what really gets you going is the ability to like look at the different experimentation on it, the data. And that's it's just a different mindset. But no doubt you've had a lot of success doing what you're doing, man. You've been crushing it over a number of years.
Well, we've returned very high returns to our investors. We don't have a bad deal in the portfolio. But I think I've been there. I've been at the point where I'm like, I want the deal with the lowest level of twists. And eventually you get to the point where you want something that's a little bit more challenging. So let me give you an example. So I'll give you an example of this. So we bought a deal in Dalton, Georgia, and Dalton's the carpet capital of the world. It's about 35 miles from Chattanooga, very nice place. And this was a gorgeous property. It was easily the best property in Chattanooga. It's up on the hills. It's next to the freeway. It's next to the college, you know, so we go in and we have zero trouble keeping the property occupied, right? Stays at 98%. We keep raising rents. And the goal was like everybody else, like Abel's properties, we're going in there to basically increase the rents and rehab the property. Mm-hmm. And so I walk in there and first thing I notice is off on the side of the property, there seems to be an empty area. So I get curious and I go back and look at the plans. And I notice that there was a 20 unit building that had burned down. And then I was like, nobody told me about this. And they were like, yeah, because the seller, they were the Coca-Cola family, super rich billionaires. They'd held the building. And then when the building burned down in 2017, they just got the money from the insurance and they didn't really like emphasize it in the offering memorandum. It was in there on page number 57. Nobody saw it. I didn't see it.
Yeah.
And so I go in there and I'm like, this is interesting. This is a 20 unit foundation. It's already built. So we go and we send an engineer in to check the foundation. And then we're like, this foundation looks really solid. So we go to the city and we say, look, 20 units is not going to cut it. But you've got a severe housing shortage. You haven't allowed any new multifamily construction in 20 years. Why don't you just let us build more units? But we can't do 20 units. It's just not worth our while. So like, okay, what is worth your while? Well, firstly, these units are like 600 square feet. We want to build like 800 square foot units, something bigger. And the city was like, oh, that's nice. What would you like to do? Well, you've got a 2-story height restriction here. We need to build 3 full stories, right? They're like, okay, and all right. And then we need to build 29 units. That's the minimum number. It was actually 30, but there's a stairwell, so you lose a unit. And they're like, okay, so you want to build 29 units. Why don't you submit it to us? So we go through this painful process of submitting 29 units to them for approval. And in the meantime, I go back to my bank, right? So the bank that had, you know, sold the property, that had loaned on the property. And they're like, over our dead body, are we going to allow you to put a lien on our property?
Yeah. Yeah.
Where someone else is involved and you're basically in the middle of our property doing construction without our approval. The answer is absolutely not. You can't do it, right? Do not put a lien on this property. And even if you think about it, we're going to beat you up. So I'm like, that's crazy. I mean, the city seems to really want to do this. And I mean, I have all this free land. I have all this free parking. This makes all the sense in the world. And the reason why nobody does super value add is because of this reason, because no lender in the US will ever allow you to put a lien on their property, right? They think of it as their property. Yeah, you think of it as yours. So I'm like, this is why nobody ever does this stuff, because there's so many buildings in the US that were built in the 70s and 80s. This one was built in 1989. That have the ability to build more units, right? The land is free. And you also, in many cases, their parking ratios were from the 80s. So you can actually use some of that parking to apply towards a new building as well. So I'm like, I have to figure this out. This is a very difficult problem. I love this building. I'm going to build it. Now that the city has approved it, I'm going to build it. So I go back to the lender and I say, so what if my existing investors gave me money to build it? Cash, right? No lending. Yeah. And they're like, you do realize it's 29 units. It's going to cost you like $3 million, right? And you're willing to dilute your investors' equity by $3 million. And we're like, no, I'm not. I'm going to find a way not to dilute the equity. And they didn't understand me, but they said, well, that seems okay to us. I mean, we still want to approve your plans, but if you can raise $3 million from your existing investors, then one could technically say that you're not going outside of the ecosystem. You're staying inside and it's your equity, obviously. We're going to look at it as just a rehab, right? Nobody prevents you from doing rehab. So I'm like, okay, fine. So this is interesting. How do I convince my existing investors to give me $3 million? But I don't want to dilute them because I don't want to bring more equity into the deal. My IRRs are going to go down. And my whole point is I'm trying to do super value add to spike my IRRs, right? So I'm like, okay. So I invented a completely new class. I called it Class X of Investing. And the Class X of Investing was, I went back to all of my investors. They were pretty happy. The building was delivering 8%. And I said, okay, I have this vision. I want to build this 29-unit building. Here's what it looks like. It's three floors, blah, blah, blah. I give them all the pitch. And I'm like, I need you guys to give me $3 million. But you can't be Class A investors. You have to be this new Class X. And they're like, what the heck is Class X? Class X is a lending class. It's a lending class that doesn't put a lien on the property. And if after 2 years I'm wrong and for whatever reason I can't sell the building or I can't refinance out of this loan, it turns into equity. So if I'm wrong, it becomes equity in a building that you already love. If I'm right, then it's just a loan you're giving me and I'll pay you 12% and I'll pay you out when I'm either refinancing or selling the building. Right? No one had ever heard of this because I just invented
it. The Class X.
Class X, right? So, and I invented and they asked me a million questions, but in the end, it makes sense to them. So we're giving you a loan. No, well, there's no lien, right? Because a bank won't let you put a lien. So it's not typically actually a loan. It's an asset class. It's an equity class. And they're like, yeah, but it's not equity. You're not giving me any back end returns. And I'm like, yes, but keep in mind that you're the direct beneficiary of me not diluting this because I'm taking money from you, my existing investors. So it doesn't make sense to make it an equity class either. So it's kind of a class that moves between equity and lending. Right now, I need equity because my lender won't let me put a lien, so it can't be a loan. But give me the ability to move it back and forth depending upon how the property is doing. And my goal is to eventually just make it a lending class and give you 12% later, right?
Yeah.
And after huge amounts of explanation, they agreed. And they ended up giving me $3 million. So I built it. I have 29 units. They're completely built. And when it's built, those 29 units, they get rented for about $30,000 a month. But nothing in the property changes. I still have the same number of employees. Nothing changes. And because this was inside an existing property, the property taxes didn't change. Now, that doesn't happen in every place, but it happened here.
Yeah.
So out of that $30,000... $24,000 was net operating income, actually more like 25. So 25 out of $30,000 of rent was NOI, just so that your listeners understand how huge that is. 25,000 a month multiplied by 12 months is 300,000. Okay. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We sold the property at 4 cap, which means that $300,000, you basically got 25 times that value. That's what 4 cap means, right? So we multiply 300,000 by 25. We made $7.5 million on this property at a $3 million cost.
Yeah,
$4.5 million.
The super value
so
add.
We go from 20% annualized to 44% annualized, right?
Yes, sir.
So this is super value add. And super value add is enormously difficult because lenders will not allow it unless you raise equity from your own investors. So you have to be very convincing to your investors.
Yeah.
But we did it. I mean, this is the sort of thing that makes my brain tick. I'm constantly looking for this kind of stuff.
Well, that's a great story.
And by the way, now my team is running
great
around
example.
The U.S. They're running around the U.S. and saying, given everything has to be purchased at 4 cap, because right now, everything you're buying, you have two options. Buy it at 3-point-something cap or like low fours, right? There's no building in the U.S. that you can buy for anything other than that. So it's like, as long as I'm going to do that, I might as well buy buildings that are zoned for higher number of units.
Yep.
And then I'll go just build them later.
Yeah, there you go. Well, super value added, man. I'm going to use a term. I'm going to say class X as well. I love it.
A fluid equity lending class that moves back and forth, but depending upon the syndicators.
I'll let you try to explain it. I'm going to tell them.
I know. It's really difficult to explain. So I try to get it done in 2 or 3 minutes, but it can't be equity. It can't be lending because equity gets back in and lending has a lien. It's floating somewhere in the middle.
You're all good, man. Well, before I spend too much time talking about this, you're the perfect person to talk about investing trends with.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to really make sure, what the heck are you seeing? How do you see it? What's your view? What's your paradigm? Like investing in general, should I even, I don't even care if it's super value add, parting with my money in the stock market versus real estate versus one or the other. Tell me what's going on. How do you read the tea leaves right now? It's bizarre. It is manipulated, was another word. There's all kinds of things going on. How do you see it? And man, let's just dig in here.
This, in my mind, is unquestionably the greatest real estate market of all time. Nothing comes close to it. And the biggest reason is that it's different from 2006, 2008. So here, I'm on record saying it's different. So later on, if I'm wrong, you know where to come to beat me.
Yeah.
It's different because the 2007-2008 crash was driven by debt. People who were gardeners outside your home used stated income to buy properties that they couldn't afford, to buy 10 properties that they couldn't afford, and then just walked away from those properties when it crashed. Today's boom is not a debt boom. It is a liquidity boom. It's a boom based on liquidity that was injected into the world economy by over 200 countries. Right? The United States alone injected about $5 or $6 trillion, somewhere in that range, maybe a little bit higher, depending upon what you consider the injection to be. And we were the biggest injector in the world, but the Brits did it, the South Africans did it, the Chinese did it, the Japanese did it. Every country in the world did some form of quantitative easing and some form of direct injection, those checks. When you inject $15 trillion into a $68 trillion world economy, you create extraordinarily bizarre effects. And these effects are not fleeting. Some of them will last for a decade. Let me give you 3 or 4 examples so you understand just how insanely bizarre this is.
Yeah.
Right? So in 2008, real estate crashed really hard, right? Yeah. Never crashed like that before.
The first time I threw an investment was 2008 when everything was going south. I go, I think I should run in right now. But that was our first deal.
It was incredible, right? So to me, keep in mind, how did we recover from that? We recovered from that because the Federal Reserve injected liquidity and the government injected direct money. So we spent $600-700 billion. We bailed the banks out. And then the Fed basically injected a couple trillion in liquidity. Liquidity is not the same as money, but it has similar effects. So let's just call it $3 trillion and say we injected $3 trillion. That $3 trillion injection balanced an extremely negative market and led to a 9-year real estate boom. Okay? $3 trillion bucks.
Okay.
Now we've injected $6 trillion into a market that was not even close to that badly damaged. There's a lot of argument that it runs for at least 5 years because the last one with half the money ran for 9 years. Okay.
Yeah.
This one with double the money should at least run for half that long, right? So 5 years. So there's a very strong argument in that favor. And then there are people who are like, no, it can't run for 5 years. That's because as soon as the Federal Reserve raises rates, cap rates are going to go up.
Okay? Yeah, we're buying at
and all of a sudden they're going to be 5 cap and okay, skip and then blah,
go
blah,
the
blah.
Opposite way. All right.
Everybody that says that is not data driven. Okay. And I'm going to prove it to you in 60 seconds. In 60 seconds, you're going to feel like a fool for saying, oh, interest rates are going to go up and cap rates are going to go up. Right. So what we know is that the Federal Reserve is publicly signaling that next year they will raise interest rates twice. Mm-hmm. So they've said, we're going to raise rates, we're going to raise them twice. And maybe they only end up raising once because often they give you the maximum number and sometimes they step down from it. They never go above what they're at because they don't want to mess with the market and cause, you know, taper tantrums and those sorts of things. And they're saying, we're probably going to raise it two more times in 2023, right? So twice and then twice, four raises. Right? That's what's ahead of us. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So here's what I would like everyone that's listening to this to do this, because I'm 100% positive I'm right. Try to prove it. Between 2015 and 2018, the Federal Reserve raised interest rates not two times, not four times, but nine times. The Fed funds rate in December 2015 was 0.25. In December 2018, 3 years later, it was 2.5. Which means nine interest rate hikes of a quarter point each. I would like one person from your huge audience, one person to show me any evidence that in those 3 years, cap rates did not continue to decline at the same rate as before 2015 and after 2018. So imagine, go Google cap rate trends multifamily, hit enter, click on images, and you'll see a bunch of graphs. And those graphs, you will see cap rates declining from their 2010 peak, declining, mm-hmm. declining. I want you to move your cursor to see in between 2015 and 2018, is there any evidence in that line that decline in cap rates even slowed down a little bit, even looked like it might plateau at any point in those 3 years that the Fed was raising interest rates three times? I tell you, there's nothing. There is a correlation between cap rates and interest rates. Everybody knows that. I accept it. What most people don't know is that you need to fire the gun 9, 10, 12, 16 times for that correlation to occur. Mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. if after the ninth time, you're still seeing that decline at the same exact rate as you were seeing 3 years before, what chances are there that two firings of that gun over the next year with such an enormous amount of liquidity would actually even start to plateau rates? I think they might plateau because they're pretty low. They're lower than they were 5 years ago. So it makes sense that they'll plateau. But when people say they're going to go up because the Fed is going to raise interest rates two times, I would suggest, sir, that you simply don't follow data. There is no data to suggest. We've had nine interest rate hikes. You've had nine chances to observe the results and you've simply ignored them all nine times. I don't think that there's any flattening or plateauing of interest rates that happens in 2022. Oh, sorry, cap rates. By 2023, because they're pretty low anyway, I expect them to start flattening. Mm-hmm. And then subsequent raises in 2024, let's assume another two raises, and then let's assume another two. 2024 and 2025 is where we could see, if you're data-driven, some increase in cap rates. They start to move up in that direction. But for people who expect them to stop moving down or plateau in the next 2 years, I think you're expecting an outcome that we have not seen before in history.
Hello, hello. You're listening to the Five Talents Podcast. I'm your host, Abel Pacheco. If you're enjoying this podcast, then I know you're serious about achieving financial freedom. Are you ready to create your own path through multifamily investing for yourself and your family? Then I know you're gonna appreciate our investor's guide to multifamily investing. It's titled Tackling Commercial Real Estate the Easy Way. We use this guide to invest ourselves in $93 million worth of real estate. So we're gonna show you the basic mechanics of multifamily syndications and how to evaluate your next passive investment opportunity. So the best part, if you subscribe to our podcast now, leave us a review and a rating, I'm going to give you a free copy of our ebook. So please take a moment to do that now. Once you've done that, go to 5tcre.com/ebook, 5tcre.com/ebook, Make sure to let us know you left a review and we're going to send you a free copy. So thank you so much for subscribing to the Five Talents Podcast. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. This is very important to understand. Most people do not even know how many times the Fed hiked rates in the last cycle. They don't even know how many times.
Yeah.
And most of them think that when the Fed hiked interest rates, cap rates went up. Please, for God's sake, can there be one person in this universe that shows me where they went up?
Yeah.
They continued to smoothly decline throughout the entire three-year period. There was no pause. There was no plateau.
Yeah.
So it's very important to understand that the correlation between interest rates and cap rates occurs once there's been 5, 6, 7, 10 hikes. Then that's when the correlation starts to go into effect.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. So for those people that are on the show that are maybe like just even grasping some straws to say, whoa, cap rate, interest rate, how does that even go together with my investment? At the very simplest terms, we're borrowing a lot of capital from lenders who are giving us a lot of capital at a very low interest rate. So say it's 3, 3.5 interest rate, just saying that, right? They're giving us $7 or $8, $10 million on a $12, $13, $14 million building. So they're giving us a good percentage of it. They're lending it to us at a very low interest rate. We're saying, hey, I will take all your money at 3.5 percentage rate. And I'm gonna raise the rest of the capital. It's the way we do it. We're syndicating it. We're raising the rest of it as our equity, all of us together. And we're betting that we can get more of a return and doing that a little bit of an arbitrage between the 3.5%, between what's being kicked out. So we like this spread of borrowing at a low and making a high. Well, as the cap rates go down, what Neil's saying is the value of the property is going up. So it's going up and up. And we're like, yes, cap rates keep shrinking because our value in this property is going up, which means our returns are better and we're making more money. We made a good bet, right? But you know, back in the 2008s, like you said, the interest rates were people in the back of their mind are saying, hey, they can't stay that low forever. They got to go up. Well, he just basically showed, hey, 9 times they raised rates. The cap rates continued to fall then, which was value of properties going up. And we're looking at somewhat of the same mindset, except more money. I think I heard this right. Double the infuse of capital or liquidity. And maybe, I don't think we're going to see 9 rate increases, maybe less, maybe the next few years. I mean, those are all good market mechanics or good economic mechanics that you're pointing out that I love. I'm like, man, buy more. This is where I'm at the mindset of to simplify it. I'm like, simpleton able. Let's buy more assets, right? So I love it.
Makes sense. Though you have to be careful, as you said, we're paying an enormous amount for these assets.
Yeah.
So I think that we need to be more careful. We need to, let me put it this way. I think we need to be extremely careful today, but the market definitely supports continued growth because of the injection of money. And the injection of money is coming in from 3 different places, actually. So number one, other asset classes that have never wanted to invest in multifamily are interested. Let me tell you, there are asset classes that people have loved more than multifamily. And one of them is office. So if you're an office investor, here's how multifamily has looked to you before COVID. There's all these people and they don't have many money. They've got $400 on average. The average tenant has $400 in the bank. You've got to collect rents from like 200 people in a 200 unit property. They have delinquency. They have no net worth. They don't care about their credit. And that's multifamily. And I'm in the office business. All of my clients are corporate and corporations, their net worths might be 5 million, 10 million, 20 million, or 20 billion. Very rarely do corporations ever default on rent because it would ruin their credit history and their ability to pick up credit to run and grow their business. The people I deal with are pretty classy. There's companies who end up changing their business plan and they end up basically renting a place for 10 years. And not just they just keep paying that rent. Or if they come to me and say, hey, let me out of my lease, I just basically go and find another client at a higher price. And if I don't, well, I don't let them out of my lease. And I have three or four or five tenants in my big office building that's $20 million as opposed to 200 tenants. And most of them upgrade the properties themselves because they want a nicer office. And all of my leases are 5 to 10 years long, right? Now you can see why there's people that love office investment. And they've always loved office more than multifamily because they've thought it was superior. That came to an abrupt halt with COVID.
Yeah.
Because what now even the most bullish office investor is, this entire massive generation of future CEOs were trained, hundreds of millions of them. These are all the CEOs of the future. They were trained on how to run businesses from home, how to be part of businesses from home. Everyone's mindset's changed. So even if 10% of the workers that were in offices do not come back, and currently there's an indication of 20%, 10% don't come back, we've got oversupply for 5 years.
Wow.
So it's a very slow meltdown because remember the average lease is 5 years and most companies are not going to default on leases if they have any money, right? So it's a slow, very slow meltdown because some leases are 10 years. So, but right now the interest in new investment in office is the lowest we've seen in history. And where do you think their money is going? Well, all of a sudden they're like, okay, I understand the value of multifamily now, right? So that money is pouring into this asset class. Money is also, there's people who are fearful, people who hate these trillions of dollars being printed. Those are the same people that are investing in Bitcoin and crypto and NFTs. They're saying, I need to go to hard assets because for 10 years, people have been talking about high inflation. It never happened. Now we have extraordinary inflation. Even the official number is 6%. The shadow stats number is 12, right? Yeah. So if you believe shadow stats, we're at 12% inflation. If you believe the official numbers, we're at 6.3. But both those numbers are outrageously high for a developed economy like the US. So now there's these people panicking and saying, oh, all those real estate dudes like Abel that were saying we're going to have high inflation, it turned out they were right.
Yeah.
Right? And so now there's this new money of people that usually like soft assets, right? Like stock market. And they're saying, I need to get into hard assets. So we are seeing a massive amount of money pour into all kinds of hard assets, not just real estate, but timber. And you can't really call, you know, Bitcoin a hard asset, but it's an alternative asset. So we are seeing money pour into alternative assets. The price of Bitcoin dropped to $7,000 a few weeks after COVID. It's up to what, 66,000? So it's up,
crushing
it's up 9 to 10 times. So when an other alternative assets are up 9x, why would real estate going up 40% be considered excessive? Look at where the stock market has gone from where it was in April to now. So the stock market has actually jumped more than real estate, right? Bitcoin has jumped many times more than real estate.
Yeah.
Why would a 30 to 40% increase in real estate, which is now being considered more of an institutional asset class, it's no longer an alternative asset class post-COVID, why would that be seen as a fear? And keep in mind, in 2005, this is another number I keep giving people. In 2005, institutional players, the people that invest billions and trillions, 5% of their holdings were real estate. And their goal was to hit 20% by 2020. They have hit that goal.
Wow.
And their new goal is to hit 40% by 2030.
Wow. The institutionals
want to double their real estate holding. They've already quadrupled it. They've gone from 5 to 20. And now they're looking to go from 20 to 40. So now you have these institutional investors that are doing new asset classes. Of the new real estate classes, unquestionably the best, by far the best, better than multifamily, no doubt in my mind, is built to rent. So between when COVID started and now, right, we've seen $75 billion raised just for built to rent.
Right? $75
billion? $75
billion
with a B,
rent from what
unlevered,
time to what time or from where
from
to where?
April 2020.
Holy moly.
To today, $75 billion have been raised by public funds.
That's crazy.
To invest into built to rent. And that's unlevered. It means you have to multiply it by four because, you know, 25% down, 75% loan. That's $300 billion that's going into built to rent.
All of these people are not foolish. Yeah, sorry to pause you. I have a little like yourself on my scale, right? where I was doing multifamily and I had an amazing partnership opportunity. We're doing 98 units of build to rent right now in Lafayette, Louisiana. And it's our first build to rent. But when I look at the numbers and the data and my pro formas, and like, we already broke ground, we already started building, the first six are up. And I'm looking at what we originally wrote from our numbers, our pro forma, to compare to actually what's happening. That thing is like a $200 freaking increase. And I go, well, we try to make this.
I'm seeing the same $200 increase. I'm seeing the same $200 increase in all of my BTR properties.
Build
the truth
to
is
rent,
this.
Baby.
Yeah. Build to rent has enormous advantages over multifamily. BTR tenants are tenants by choice. They don't want to, they want to live in a single family home or a townhome. They do not want to live in an apartment.
Yeah.
And so they're renters by choice. They stay twice as long. They don't trash the property. And on average, they don't have $400 in the bank. They have about $10,000 in the bank.
Wow.
And our average BTR renter has $10,000 in the bank. An average Class C tenant has roughly $400 in the bank. So an average Class C tenant cannot afford a breakdown of a car.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's terrible to say that in the richest country in the world, that half of our population basically can't afford their car to be broken down. But it also shows how awful America's financial literacy training is for, you know, the people that live here. So to me, BTR is by far the largest investment. No other investment landscape has seen anything like this. You're going to see a massive number of BTR projects, both townhome and single family. And they're little homes. I mean, most of the people building BTR are building 1,000, 1,200, 1,500 square
foot
homes.
We're doing 1,200 right? square foot, three
1,200
bedroom,
is just a sweet
two bathroom,
spot, right?
1,200
just a sweet
square
spot
houses.
Right there. So yeah. The goal is to give people the single family feel without the bloatware, the McMansion bloatware that we've seen in the last 20 or 30 years. That was a one-time thing. It can't happen again because we're running out of land. So I think that there's a lot of growth there. You're going to see a ton of growth there. I don't think it'll really affect multifamily rents. To be honest, people ask me, is this going to affect us? And the answer is,
class,
in the next
right?
two or three years, no. In the next 5, 6, 7 years, sure. In the end, the number of units will get raised. And what's happening is some of the money is actually going from multifamily new construction to BTR. So these multifamily units are not getting built, right?
Yeah.
BTR units are getting built. So some of it is just money moving. And mm-hmm. and so I feel bullish. I feel bullish despite the fact that there's no reason for real estate to be going up so fast. There's no reason for rents to be going up this fast. Our population is not increasing. It's slowing down. So there's a lot of negative trends in the marketplace. But what is supporting us is the excessive and continuous financialization of real estate by Wall Street, by the Federal Reserve, and by the US government. Those are all extraordinarily supportive of real estate, even though real estate trends by themselves are not very strong, especially given our population growth is slowing, our immigration rates are down to almost zero. And so there's foundational issues that are smaller than these amazing injections that are coming in from the government, the Fed, and from other asset classes.
Well, you, man, there's so many things going through my mind as you're talking. I love it. One of them is the feel a sense of security or the just a little feel of, I feel safe, more safe about going into real estate right now is I'm sure you have data points that support the supply versus the demand of housing in general. And there's probably way more demand, way more population growth than there are clean, comfortable, safe housing options. And then the government is they're putting in a lot of money into it. They can't provide housing for everybody. So they need somebody to do it. And I'm just I feel like I'm sliding right in, falling in line with some of the government programs and incentives and tax benefits to do my part to provide housing for people that need it. And along the way, we're doing both. We're meeting, helping try to meet the demand and also trying to create wealth for our investors at the same time, right? So,
I do want to comment on this. So there's a person. So we've talked about all the positives. There's a negative.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean anything today, but it's an extremely important negative. Ivy Zelman is a brilliant economist. She predicted the 2008 crash. She's famous. Her company now is owned by Walker Dunlop. I think everyone should watch YouTube videos, recent YouTube videos. She did one that was brilliant for Wealthion. So you might want to type in Wealthion, Wealthion, space Ivy Zelman, into YouTube and watch that video. She's absolutely right. U.S. population growth is slowing. U.S. immigration growth is slowing radically. In 5 years, we will no longer be able to make the argument that's valid today. You made an argument. We need homes. Right now, we need roughly 5 million homes. We're 5 million short, right?
Yeah.
Keep in mind, I expect that to go to 2 million in 5 years. So this concept that real estate will always have a shortage was only true as long as the US's population growth and immigration growth was strong. Both are extraordinarily weak in 2021. More and more people want to have less kids or no kids.
Less kids.
So
okay, yeah, yeah.
This doesn't last. In my case, I'm saying I understand fully that Ivy Zelman is absolutely correct. And by 2025, we simply will not be able to say many of the things we say today. My point is, I am positioning myself for an exit in that time frame. Earlier on, before we started the podcast, I told Abel, I'm currently raising $67 million for a large fund. And the reason why we raised $45 million in the last 48 hours is I am ridiculously blunt with my investors. I tell them this real estate thing can't last because by 2025, we'll be 2 million short of homes, not 5 million. And we'll be lucky if we're at 2 million, might be down to a million. And so to me, what was most compelling to my investors that gave me more money than they've ever done in the history was I was pre-selling the whole project. I was pre-selling before construction through CBRE. $400 million portfolio, single buyer. So I'm not getting the best cap rate. I'm actually, you know, not showing the highest rents. And they still loved it because by the end of 2024, I'd be done, right? Every one of those assets would be sold as soon as it was delivered. In fact, it's being pre-sold, so it's actually going to be sold next year. So it is important to understand that we're in an absolutely extraordinary market. If you looked at 10 real estate indicators today, and this will never happen again, they're all at 10 out of 10. Every indicator is 10 out of 10. So while we are in an incredible marketplace, it's very clear to me that there's only one place to go, down. But in real estate, let's assume we are at 100 today. To get to 70, which is still an incredible place, would take 3 years, right?
Wow. Yeah.
So I do think that we are going to see some issues with real estate in the 2024, 2025 time because the public does not understand that the shortage of real estate is not forever anymore. Sure. Until 2019, I felt that it was forever, that we would never catch up. In fact, that was getting worse. But 2019 and 2020 have had the worst demographic numbers for the US that since the Second World War. People don't want to have babies anymore. People don't want to get married anymore. And both Republican and Democrat governments are now in favor of slowed immigration because it's a political third rail, right? So the Democrats don't want to be seen as people that are letting rapists in. And then the Republicans, obviously, it's one of their platforms. So now you've got two parties that are opposed to significant immigration. And immigration has been one of the reasons for real estate, you know, values to go up. So the trends that I'm seeing in the last 2 years are pretty awful. And if these are replicated for the next 5 years, we get to a point where there's a balance being reached. And we make our money because of imbalances. So everyone should know this. None of it affects your next 2 years.
Yeah, it's not
but
today.
It does affect very strongly the 2 years after that.
It's a cycle. When you talk about real estate, it's literally a cycle. It does go up and down.
Yep. So well, it's only been going up for a long time. I do think that there's a downturn that comes. I do not think it comes in the next 24 months.
Here we go. Stop buying up. Well, Mr. Bawa, I don't want to monopolize your schedule, sir. I know you have some big capital to raise. Go crush this 400 unit. I'm super excited that you just take a few minutes for those investors, our network, for people who want to reach out, get into your world, maybe get in this next investment opportunity. Where do I go? How do I connect with you? Where do I reach you? That kind of stuff. And who do you want to reach out to you?
Yeah. So on podcast, to be honest, we don't tell investors we've got a project that you should invest in. That's not us. Our goal is to introduce you to our analytics. And maybe in a year or 2 years, you'll be ready to invest with us. And we strongly prefer that. The best way to connect with us, if you're data-driven, if you're a geek and you like learning more about the geekery of real estate, is either to just type my first name and last name. I'm the only Neil Bawa on the World Wide Web. So you can type in N-E-A-L space B-A-W-A, hit enter into Google, and you'll see all kinds of very interesting things related to us, none of them a project or a pitch, that I think you should familiarize yourself with. If you want to make it simpler for yourself, you can just go to a website. It's called multifamilyu.com, multifamily followed by the letter u.com. And dozens of our webinars and dozens of webinars of other equally geeky people are stored there. And I think you'd really enjoy it. Some are very short form, some are an hour long, some are PowerPoint driven, some are discussions. Check those out. And I think if you find that to resonate with you, I'm sure there's some link in there that gets you to our investment website. And then you can start in a process of engagement. We always tell people, when it comes to investing, take it slow. Make sure that the people you're investing with, your philosophy agrees with theirs.
Very good. Mr. Neil Bawa, thank you very much for joining us on the show. We really appreciate it. If you found some value in this conversation, I know you did, like, subscribe, go to the podcast, leave a written review, go connect with Neil and his team, Multifamily U, and get some more information. We look forward to having you. And Neil, thank you very much for your time, brother.
Thanks for having me on the show, Abel.
All right. We'll talk to you next time. See ya.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Five Talents Podcast with your host, myself, Abel Pacheco. Each week, we're going to bring you interviews from industry experts and commercial real estate investors who followed their dreams and achieved massive success. Before you leave, let me ask you a few questions. Did you enjoy this episode? Did you learn something valuable? Was your mind stretched to what's possible and what you can achieve? Do you want other experts just like the one you heard today? If you answered yes to any or all of those questions, then please take a moment to subscribe to the Five Talents Podcast, give us a 5-star rating, and most importantly, leave us a written review. Tell us what you liked, tell us your favorite guest, give us any feedback. I'm excited to learn and improve so you can get a more valuable show. So thank you again for subscribing to the Five Talents Podcast.